Welcome to the Predictable Revenue Podcast, where frontline sales leaders teach you how to build and scale an outbound sales team. Today's video is brought to you by Predictable Revenue's service LinkedIn Outbound. Find out how we can leverage and grow your existing LinkedIn network to book meetings into your calendar at the link below. Welcome back to the Predictable Revenue Podcast. I'm your host, Colin Stewart. Today, I'm joined by Justin Welsh. He's a guy who has helped a number of SaaS companies and sales leaders scale or accelerate the recurring revenue towards and beyond $50 million. Justin, I'm really excited to have you on the show today.
Colin, great to be here, man. Thanks for having me on.
Man, thanks for joining us. This is going to be a good one. This is we're talking about culture and how to build a culture that attracts top performers. And specifically on a sales team, this is probably, I mean, make or break for most companies. You have a ton of experience in building not just sales teams, but the culture that really drives performance there. Talk to me about, and I know you help companies kind of build this culture among many things, but can you talk to me, or tell me the story of like, where did this idea come from?
Yeah, this idea really came from when I was getting my own executive career started. Some people may know me from my previous business, which is a company called Patient Pop here in Los Angeles, where I live. And I grew that business from $1 over $50 million in recurring revenue. And when I sat down in 2015 to take on that role, I sat down and I thought, what kind of team do I want to build, right? Everyone knows they want to build a strong sales team, but I really just landed on this very simple idea that happy and motivated people sell to and treat your customers with respect. And so when I thought about that, I just thought, hey, it can't just be top performers. There has to be a unique culture that goes along with hiring top performers, because I want everyone fluidly to move together to really serve our customers. So I sat down and back in 2015, started thinking of all the different things that needed to be a part of our sales organization's culture in order to build that thriving team. And that's where this sort of 8-step program that I talk about a lot came from.
Very cool. And before we jump into the 8 steps, I'd love to just, if you could pull out a couple of points of like, what do most people get wrong?
Yeah. Great question. I think the two most common things I see that people get wrong with sales culture is they're actually confused about what culture is. So they believe culture is amenities, right? A lot of times if I ask someone, tell me about the culture of your business, you know, and obviously some of this is pre-COVID and some things are changing, but like they'll say, hey, it's dogs in the office. We have beer on tap. We got a ping pong table. And to me, that's not culture. To me, those are amenities. Culture is the attitude and behavior that your team exudes each day in pursuit of your company objectives. That to me is what culture is. So people, they're focused on the wrong thing. They're focused on amenities. And then the number two thing I always see people miss is during change, which is a huge part of that impacts your culture, they miss the why behind the change. They often tell you the what and they tell you the how, but they forget to talk about the why. And if you string together a bunch of missed why opportunities, you start to poison your culture. So those are two sort of areas that I see people, I don't know if you want to call them, you know, get wrong, but at least screw up on early on.
It seems like so easy that, you know, to when you think culture and HR, especially if you're thinking of, you know, California or Silicon Valley, you think of like all the things that come along with working at a startup, at least on the surface level. It's the ping pong tables, it's the foosball, it's the bean bags, it's the remote or flexible, you know, this and that. But I think what you're driving towards is it's the core, really, like core behaviors of the team,
yep.
Those sort of the norms that we hold ourselves to, that's really going to drive performance and attract top players.
That's right. And you can actually build a thriving culture with very few amenities. And so I would just encourage people not to get those two things confused, because it's so important. And Colin, you kind of said something interesting. It's like, it seems like a really easy thing to build. It seems like, hey, I'm just going to hire people, treat them well, give them opportunities, and bing, bang, boom, I'm going to have this thriving culture. But it's actually really hard. And as your team scales and grows and you're managing multiple personalities and people, it just becomes really challenging. So that's why I think it's all about laying the foundation. That's why I created this.
Love it. So talk to me about how we lay a really strong foundation for a great sales culture.
Yeah. To me, step one is hiring correctly. And, You know, when I think about hiring correctly, I think about really sort of 3 points. One is I only want to bring people into my organization that are aligned with my mission, vision, and values. Compensation only goes so far. Intrinsic motivation lasts only a certain amount of time. Like, to me, you have to be really bought in to the mission, vision, values of the company. And so you need to create interview questions that uncover whether or not the person sitting in front of you is actually or truly interested in your mission, vision, and values. To me, that's really important. The second thing I look at when hiring people is, are they swimming in the right lanes? And what I mean by this is, if I ask, you know, sales leaders, what kind of people do you want to hire? They say top performers. And we all want to hire top performers, but top performer in one industry and company doesn't necessarily mean top performer in another. So what I found to be really, really helpful is to stay in two lanes, your sales cycle lane and your deal size lane. So I run SMB SaaS business teams. That's what I do. So my average contract is, you know, 15K and we sign it in 15 days. So when I'm going out and I'm looking to hire salespeople onto the teams that I'm building, I want someone who's been in those lanes before. You know, if I think back at PatientPop, I remember interviewing a guy who was a medical device rep and he was selling $1 million capital equipment and he was doing it on 6 month sales cycles. And I thought, oh, capital equipment in the healthcare space, this would be a great transition into our business. And he was overwhelmed by the velocity of the sale. And so the next thing I do is I establish these velocity lanes, you know, in terms of deal size and deal velocity. And the last one is just hyper curious. And, you know, I people will ask me like, hey, what's the number one trait that a positive salesperson has? To me, it's just curiosity. You know, if you're curious and you want to know how things work, you naturally will figure things out. It takes care of almost all of the other soft skills is if you're just curious. If you Google things, if you teach yourself things, if you watch YouTube videos to get educated, you are going to be someone who is likely, it turns into a top performer. So aligned with mission, vision, values, swimming in the right lanes in terms of deal velocity and deal size, and then hyper curious. And that curiosity should come out in the questions they ask during the interview.
I love that. I think if anything has gotten me to, you know, anywhere in my sales career, it's been the fact that I was annoyingly curious at every role that I've been in. And I do want to just take that a moment to dive into that. You're in swimming in the right lane. So how, like, you've got these two lanes, and one is sort of one is deal size, and one, and the second one was like sales motion in terms of like inside sales. Did I get that right?
Yep. Yeah, velocity. How fast do your deals close? Yep.
Gotcha. How far, like, so are you saying you won't touch somebody if they're kind of only have one or two? So if they, maybe they were selling $50,000 deals, or maybe they were selling, you know, in the industry, but not touching that sort of like, maybe it was, they had a sales engineer. You're totally staying away from them?
So it's a great question. When you're building the beginning of a sales team, you can afford to go ad lib, right? So someone says, hey, this guy or gal is totally not in either of those lanes, but they have XYZ, which I think means they'll be a really great fit in your organization. You can interview those people. And by the way, you can hire people outside of those lanes and find a successful person. I'll never argue that you can't do that. But at scale, it becomes harder to ad lib. Right? So that's where you put in kind of these parameters. And so rather than, you know, my recruiting team coming to me and saying, we have 75 people here that we think would be a great fit that don't meet your lanes, do you want to go through each one of them? Like, at scale, that becomes really challenging. So part of what you need to set up is a system that increases the likelihood that the person that you hire will perform well. So the answer is not no, I won't look at them. It's just, I want to decrease the likelihood that I make a poor hire as my team grows. And I don't have a lot of time to ad lib or ad hoc. So I put in guardrails, and that's how I think about those things.
That's fair. And especially, I guess, if we're talking about an early team, you know, sure. You know, those first five reps that you hire are going to be, you know, each rep is 20% of your sales team. And so if one of your people isn't used to the motion, you know, that's 20% of your team that's automatically falling behind just because of their hiring profile.
That's right. And, like, by the way, if you analyze all your top performers at your business, anyone listening out there, they might find that velocity and deal size don't matter. Maybe it's two other things. I think the picture that I'm trying to paint is you need to have good hiring criteria, and you need to make sure that you're adjusting your hiring criteria on a regular basis to make sure that when you talk to 100 people, you have the best likelihood that those 100 are going to be successful in your business. And that might be different criteria for different people.
Well said. And so if we've nailed the hiring element, what comes next?
I think this is where the very beginning of setting expectations comes in. And I so frequently see people or businesses make a hire where someone's been through a pretty rigid and long interview process. They've come in, they've met with the team, they've done virtual calls, they get the extended offer, they show up, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I didn't understand. I thought the compensation was structured this way. I thought the quota was structured this way. I thought my support was going to work in this particular way. And it's like, oh, yeah, no, we're misaligned here. And so for me, expectations of how the job works should be introduced in the interview stage. And I just don't think those are done clearly enough or regularly enough by companies so that there's miscommunication throughout the entire stage. So set clearly defined expectations during the interview stage. When they come into training, those should be documented and shared. So the first time you show up for day one of work, you should have your compensation, how it works, your quota, how it works, your support, how it works, your career pathing, all your options at the company, how do I move laterally? Everything should be introduced to you day one. And then when you graduate training, you should be signing off on all of those expectations. There should never be an instance where someone sits down in their desk for the first day of work and says, oh, I thought my quota was X and it's actually Y. I misunderstood. And I just see it happen so frequently. What a bad way to get started in a relationship.
Oh, for sure. You're getting off on the wrong foot. And it's like you have the wrong firmware for this person that's supposed to be operating to drive a ton of revenue for you. And it can be such a missed opportunity. I'm curious, how deep into the details do you go? Are you getting down into specific activity levels? Like, we're expecting your demos to come from here. We expect you to follow up, you know, this many times. We expect to, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Anything that we're measuring or holding people accountable to, I want to introduce as soon as possible. I really fear hiring someone and then they sit down at their desk and, you know, you come over and say, cool, you're ready to make your 80 calls today. And they're like, 80, the recruiter told me 60. And it's like, boy, I guess we got to reset expectations on day one of work. And this looks like a bait and switch. And this isn't what I was told. And it becomes this really big problem. So for me, it's like anything they're going to be held accountable to, anything that we're going to be pointing at, anything that we're going to be reviewing, I want to introduce day one.
Gotcha. It's all out in the open and on the table.
That's right.
And so we've got the right hire. We're hiring by our core values. We're hiring and firing, living by the core values. We're hiring the right profile. We're finding curious people. We're setting the expectations in that interview, in the interview stage. And then we're following through to make sure that, you know, during the onboarding process, we're reinforcing that. So now I'm a rep sitting at your, at a desk. I got my Salesforce open. What comes next?
Yeah, I think the next thing that comes is kind of three questions I ask myself is I want to provide learning and development for my reps. And so the questions I ask myself is, do they know how to do the job? Do they know how to do the job well? And do they know why they're doing their job? So for instance, I see so many times where career pathing and learning and development just doesn't make sense. As you grow, you actually part of the career roles you take on have skills that you've never learned. And so that's the how and the well part. Like, how do I do my job and how do I do it well? Each job should be building upon the previous foundation. So for instance, at my previous business, you came in and you learned to qualify inbound leads and you learned a long time and you spent a long time qualifying inbound leads. And then as soon as you got really good at that, you were put into a boot camp where during the mornings, you were taught how to prospect cold. Right? So you were taught that for probably 6 consecutive months, 1 hour a morning. You're talking about 120 hours of training on one particular skill set. And once you qualified for that and were certified, you got moved up to an outbound prospector. But day one, you weren't making your first outbound cold call. You've been practicing for 120 hours. So what I want to see is learning and development should build upon itself. I think that's really important. And I think that you need to have coaches that focus on each of those things. So one thing that I instilled at Patient Pop with the help of my VP of Inside Sales, Kevin Dorsey, who is really the mastermind behind this particular point, which is onboarding coaches. So coaches that are really specific around helping people up-level their skills when they first come into the organization. And so we give people an onboarding coach and they report to one manager during their ramp period so that they can learn all the fundamental skills and that manager's been trained on that. And they get an onboarding buddy, someone who's a top performer that can help them navigate the organization effectively so they know where to go for things. And then maybe lastly, kind of closing it all out, is what I call VP or exec level engagement. And I think that the executive on the sales team, whether it's a CRO or an SVP of sales or whatever, really can help connect the company dots. So one thing that I always like to do is engage with the team on a regular basis and remind them, how are all of our jobs connected? Like, how do I depend on the guy below me and how does he depend on the girl below him and so on and so forth down the ladder and then right back up the ladder? How are we all connected? I want ownership of people's jobs. I want them to know that other folks in the organization depend on them doing their job effectively. And so I think that VP level or that C-level engagement on the sales org is really critical to really round it all out.
Beautiful. Interesting note. We actually had Kevin Dorsey was, I think, the seventh guest on the show. Arguably the coolest, I think his episode was 007. Nice. And it was one of those ones where you had some amazing guests. And I just remember getting on the, having him on the show and just being totally in awe of realizing how little I knew about sales management, coaching and development. I think he was at Snack Nation back at the time.
Yeah, Katie's great. He was at Snack Nation and Service Titan. And then I hired him on as my VP of inside sales and he ran my inside sales team. And then I had a field sales team and a channel sales team as well. But he's an excellent leader, a great coach, and I'm sure a hell of a podcast guest.
He was definitely a hell of a podcast guest. I want to say we actually had the pleasure of one of his reps closed a deal while we were recording. And so he like took us out of the room and you could see them like ringing the gong. Everybody was super jazzed. And so if I reset to the process here, if I come back to the process, we've onboarded them well, we've built out this learning and development plan. What is the next stage? Because I imagine that doesn't go away. That's an ongoing continuous thread that we're going to weave throughout the entire engagement.
Totally. I think step four is building out that right career path, the one that I was referencing when talking about step three. And I take a different theory or approach to career pathing in promotional pathing. So I come from an era, I graduated school in 03. And when I came into the market, like you usually worked at a job for a minimum of 2 years before you were eligible for a promotion. And I think in this era of limited attention spans, it's really important to give people things that happen quickly all the time and for people to shoot for something on a regular basis. And so I'm a huge fan of having multiple sales roles. Like if you look at a company like Yelp, they've got 15 different AE roles that you can move through. I love that. I want people to be hunting for that next role. So I make promotions frequent and not just frequent, but I like to unlock wins at every level. So every promotional level should come with a small salary increase. Every promotional level should come with an opportunity to make a larger OTE. It should come with stock or equity grants if your company is doing that. It should come and unlock new leads or new opportunities or new partners. I always want the guys and gals on my team to be striving for that next role all the time. And by making them 6 month to 8 month career pathing promotional opportunities, you get this hungry team that's just constantly looking to move forward. And I don't know, in the sales organizations that I've built, that's worked really well for me because everyone's just driving towards the same goals. And that's, in turn is driving the company revenue really effectively.
I could see how that would create a team that is constantly focused on what is the next thing. And it's not just settling into I've hit my quota and I'm comfortable. Right? You create sales these little...
Sorry, I was going to say sales is monotonous, man. Like you hit quota for 18 consecutive months and there's no... I mean, yeah, you take home a nice paycheck. Don't get me wrong, but there's no win. There's no achievement. I like to gamify everything. I'm just a big fan of that.
Dude, it sounds like had I worked for you when I was early in my sales career, I'd still be in sales because I can look back to my first couple of jobs and they went two ways. It was... I came on and I either I wasn't super aligned with the product and I didn't stay there, or I loved the product. I loved the company. I crushed it. I was super interested for about 18 months. Then I got bored and I started looking for something else. And it wasn't a financial decision. It was, I'm so bored of this. I need to find something different.
Totally. And I think there's a step later on that I'll touch on that I think will help alleviate that boredom, even as you move through the promotional path.
A teaser. I love it. And so we've nailed the career path. We've got little wins, little bumps in salary and OTE, which kind of brings us to compensation. So talk to me about how we get compensation right.
Yeah. Don't mess this up, right? Like of all the things I just talked about, comp is still important. And if people can't make a fair wage or, you know, they're not getting paid for what they're producing, that's a problem. But with that being said, I'm also cognizant that as the executive, my core responsibility is to the company. And so I like a compensation plan that is fiscally responsible and also highly incentivizes salespeople to perform well. So I stole a comp plan from Jason Lemkin off of his Saster blog that I've used really effectively. And that is, you know, that folks will pay back their base salary first. So they're gonna have to make enough deals to where they meet their MRR targets and they've effectively paid their salary and seat costs back. So usually that's like salary with a 20% load on top. But once they cross that threshold, you can pay them a significant portion of every deal. You can pay them 20, 25, maybe even more percent of the deal. And so what that does is it takes money out of the pockets of bottom performers and puts it into the pockets of top performers. For instance, most companies I talk to are like, oh, we pay 2% on the first X thousand, then 4%, then 6%. Why? Why not take all those percentage points and move them to the top tier and pay your top performers as much as you possibly can? If you do anything else, you're robbing your top performers and you're paying your bottom performers. So this compensation plan means my top performers are making a ton of money and they're hustling hard throughout the course of the month or quarter because they love those accelerators at the top. And it also means that my bottom performers will likely not pay their seat back costs back, will probably not make any commission and will self-select out. May sound cruel, may sound non-empathetic, but in the end of the day, like, you know, if you're not a top performing salesperson at a company, you may not be at the right company. And I'd rather make sure that my top performers are really, really satisfied.
And I'll try and I believe I've read that blog post, but yeah. I haven't actually lived that blog post. And so talk to me a little bit about how that works. So so let's assume we're on a monthly recurring revenue basis or a business. And I'm a new hire. So I'm getting my base and then I'm also on a commission plan. So on the first few deals, Sam selling deals, they're 12K ACV or annual contract value. And so do I not make any commission on the first, say where my base is $4,000 a month, US, I get zero commission until I get, until I pass 4K monthly recurring on the books.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, actually probably more, probably 4,800 to 5K. I like to put a cushion on top for software and seat costs. Gotcha. But then once you cross that threshold, instead of being this 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, I pay 25%. So next time you close a $12,000 deal, I'll pay you 3K. So, you know, if you've got reps who are closing 11 deals, right, a month, which a lot of my reps were at a pretty similar average contract value to what you just suggested, you can do the math and it gets pretty gnarly at the top. You know, I remember looking at my top performers and the finance team coming and saying, did you know that this person made $365,000 last year and she is only 24? And I'm just like, I don't care how old the person is, how experienced, I don't care about any of that stuff. All I care about is, you know, if she's doing the 1.5 or 2 million or whatever she sold, like she should reap the rewards for that. So as long as she's paying her seat costs off, it works with the finance team.
100%. And such a great attitude. I've been in a number of situations where people are like, hey, you're making more than the CEO, so we got to do something. And I've heard that a number of times and it's like, man, that's, yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah, I don't believe in tenure-based rewards. I believe in performance-based reward.
I love that. And so that's getting compensation right. And compensation, it is one of those things. It's like it's that internal recognition that hey, I'm doing a good job. I'm getting paid healthily. But there's also the sort of external recognition. Talk to me about what you guys or how you see sort of recognition outside of the comp plan.
Yeah, this to me is like super critical. And it's critical to me because I was never, you know, I hate the word coin operated salesperson. That's so such a dumb term. Whoever coined that, probably someone I actually really like and I just threw him under the bus. But
I just got to call that out.
Hey, good one. I didn't recognize that pun there. So for me, it was always about recognition. I like to be recognized. I like to be recognized in front of my peers. That is what drove me. So I want to do the same for my team because I'm sure everyone is motivated differently. So the first thing that we did is we had something called daily mantra goals, which was recognition for the team if they achieved their team's daily goal. And so like for our SDR department, I can still remember it. This was many years ago, but it was like 2,402 was our chance. Like we make 2,400 dials, we convert 2% of them, and we come away as a team with 48 scheduled demos. And like people were jazzed to hit those goals because we monitored them on, around the office using our ambition software. And every time the team would hit the goal, we'd drop $50 into a bucket. And it's like, yeah, it's $50, no big deal. But if you hit it all across your 20 work days, you got $1,000 in that bucket. And at the end of the month, we would draw a name out. They'd walk home $1,000 richer. Now, it's not about the money, it's about the team, right? And so you could see sometimes someone throwing on their backpack at like 4:45 and they're walking out the door and everyone's like, hey, we're at 47 demos, bud. Like back to the seat, we're gonna work as a team until we nail this. And then everyone's cheering each other on trying to get that last demo. I love team-based goals. And so I like to recognize when the team does something great. We also have our weekly and monthly leaderboard. I mean, we email those out. We put them around monitors on the office. That's just pretty standard stuff. We also had some pretty cool monthly contests. So I think everything's changing with COVID, right? I think companies are more cash aware and things like that. But we had a couple of really fun contests where people could win a private plane and, you know, two nights in a hotel in Vegas or wine country with a significant other if they, you know, won the revenue of the quarter award. And we put them up on a wheel and spin it and someone would take that home. So people loved that. And then quarterly awards. Like I know quarterly awards sounds like something really simple and it is, but it's not about emailing the awards. It's not about sending the awards to their office. I marched every single salesperson that won an award every quarter in front of the whole company. And people used to complain, do we have to do the sales awards? Those are like 40 minutes long. Absolutely. It is 40 minutes well spent. It's 40 minutes where all the winners have smiles on their faces and they feel like heroes in front of the rest of the organization. Telling me you're not willing to invest 40 minutes of time in your top salespeople to make sure that they're motivated to do it again next quarter. No way. For me, I never wanted to miss those things. So quarterly awards and recognizing in front of the company was huge.
Right on. And so awards, we're talking about like biggest sale, fastest, like most cold calls, like what kind of stuff are you talking about?
No, I never reward inputs. I only reward outcomes. So it's never about most calls or anything like that. It's about revenue. Right? So who led the field sales team in revenue? Who led the inside sales team in revenue? The channel sales team? No, we would do like rookie of the quarter, things like that, but it was always based on outcomes and never on inputs.
Gotcha. Love it. And so talk to me about the role that surprise and delight plays.
Hmm. Yeah, this is the one where I think talking about kind of not letting it get boring. I'll give you a really quick story of what I mean by surprising and delighting generously. That's sort of my step seven. I'll give you a very quick story. So I was the second sales hire at a company called ZocDoc in New York back in 2009. And it was just 10 people when I joined there. And that business ended up growing to almost a $2 billion valuation and 750 people. But very early on in my career, I was the top salesperson there. And I made enough money to move into my own bedroom in the city in East Village. And it was 11.5 by 6.5 feet. And I couldn't fit anything except for a futon in there. And so I bought this really shitty futon. It was like rock solid. And I would go to bed and it was so uncomfortable. And so I walk into the office one morning and Cyrus Masumi, the CEO at that time and founder of ZocDoc, saw me and I looked exhausted. And he said, hey, you look totally exhausted. What's going on? Told him this quick story. He walks back into his office. He comes out with a check and it's blank, hands it to me, tells me to go to Sleepy's, I think was 13th and 2nd back in the day in Union Square, and buy a mattress and spend up to $1,000. And I was like, whoa. No one has ever done something this kind for me before. I was 28 years old. And so I went to Sleepy's and I spent like $498, I think, on a mattress. And it was the best single mattress I'd ever slept on. And like, I always remember that. Like every day that I went to the office, every day that I went to work, like I remembered this bed that the CEO bought me. What an investment. And I said, like, looking back, it was a $498 investment. It bought 5 years of loyalty and top performance. Like, that's amazing. And so I try and do the same thing. And I don't just do it around, you know, if people are tired, but I like to do something I call collecting hobbies. So I like to have my ears open. What do people like? Surfing, playing guitar, going to concerts, like what is it they like? And when they do something really well, I like to find a personal gift, right? So a guy on my team named Jeff Parker at PatientPop was a sales analyst. And, you know, I heard him talking about SQL database, and I'm not smart enough to know what that stuff is, but he was such a strong performer that one quarter I walked up and said, "Hey man, General Assembly down the street on Second Street's doing a SQL database course. It's $1,200. I bought you the 3-month course membership." And he was just completely enthralled. And that's just because I just was listening and I just heard him say that. And you know, Jeff's still at PatientPop and, you know, is a loyal dude. So I love making those investments. And last but not least is I like to just make myself available. I think every executive should be having office hours. I think every executive can learn from hearing from the people on the front lines. And if you're not willing to give up your time, then you're probably going to miss a lot of really, really incredible learnings. So that's what I think about is just surprising and delighting people generously is with you know, personal thoughtful gifts and giving them your time.
And I love the fact that these gifts are personalized. It's not monetary. It's not like you're handing somebody, you know, "Hey, you did a great job. Here's $480. Right? Cause that's a one-time feel good of like, "Oh, you handed me $1,000 check." I think you're kind of proof of this, that if your CEO had just handed you $1,000 check, and said, you know, "Go get it sorted. Let me cover that." You know, it would have been a much different story from, "Hey, you know, go buy yourself a mattress."
Totally. 100%. Money you spend, it's gone. There's no reminder. Every night that I got a good night's sleep, every morning that I woke up feeling refreshed, I could tie that back to my business. What a great thing to think about when you think about your company is, you know, a good night's sleep, feeling refreshed and feeling thankful.
Phenomenal. And that mattress was a part of your life for totally. Those 5 years. And like you said, a constant reminder.
I still have it.
Do you really?
I do. It's in my parents' house in Ohio, but I have it.
That's phenomenal. I can't think of anything that I've bought for. Actually, you know what? No, I've got one thing that I guarantee. I got it for one of our guys who was doing a great job, and he's into magic cards. And so I did a little bit of research, and I found a great one, and it was a really, really old one, and one that I knew he wouldn't spend that kind of money on himself. I got it for him, and I guarantee he'll never sell that, and it'll be like a source of pride every time he looks at it.
Totally. When you think about rewarding your team with a gift, just think about buying something for your significant other.
Totally. And the funny experience is that buying him that card was like, I had a great time doing it. I felt amazing. So selfishly, it was also a really awesome thing for me that I get to.
Yeah, it's great.
So we've talked about making sure we're recognizing people and surprising them and delighting them. How do we make sure that everything stays on track? And talk to me a little bit about how you solicit feedback from the team.
Yeah, definitely. So there are three things that I think are really important when it comes to having a feedback loop. The first one is just a simple anonymous suggestion box. And I don't mean like a physical box. It could be a, you know, Google Forms or whatever, you know, software you use, but you want to make it anonymous and you want to encourage people to leave feedback. But with the caveat that I don't read feedback unless it's solutions oriented. I'll tell the salespeople like, "Hey, you can send in 50 pieces of feedback. If it's just complaining, I'm not going to read it. If it's just pointing out a problem, unlikely to read it. If you point out a problem, you say, here's an option that I considered for a potential solution, I'll read those all day. I just won't deal with like using a suggestion box as a complaining box. That's why I don't read Glassdoor reviews for the most part. It's usually 1 or 5 stars. I don't really learn anything. So like make it anonymous, make it solutions oriented, set the expectation that you won't address them unless they're solutions oriented, and you get really great feedback. That's number one for me. Number two is quarterly ENPS surveys. So employee net promoter score. So you want to measure your promoters, your neutrals, and your detractors. Are they going up, down, staying the same? What are the consistent themes? What's the sentiment analysis? You know, all that different stuff. I analyze that every quarter when I run teams, just to make sure that we're not taking our foot off the gas or our eye off the ball on a particular topic. And then the last one, which I think is the most fun and the most rewarding and the most helpful, is what I call the Senate team. And this is an elected group of salespeople that aggregate feedback and present it to leadership. So each division, inside sales, sales development, field sales, channel sales, their reps will elect a senator. And that senator, again, peer elected, and that senator will go around and collect feedback from their team. And they'll kind of aggregate that feedback and make it really neat and clean. And then we'll all, you know, pre-COVID, we all went out to dinner. And the senators each got about 15 minutes to walk through the feedback that they got from their group. And then the leadership team, myself and some of my leaders like Kevin, made a commitment to have addressable points within 2 weeks. It's like, great, these seven things, we heard you guys, these are going well, these four things are challenging. In 2 weeks from now, we'll present to the Senate team what our solutions and suggestions are to help solve these four things. And that kept like everybody connected top to bottom, right? You got leadership team working with peer elected senators who are working with, you know, the folks that elected them. It's a pretty cool system. You know, it works a lot better, you know, at Patient Pop than it works, you know, in the world.
not a topic that I am, yeah, I have a background to cover, but I'll just say, yep. Mm-hmm. But I love the idea. It kind of answers one of the pieces that I've been trying to figure out with predictable revenue. We've pushed the whole company remote because we've had to, and people's safety and all that. And we're trying to figure out, how do we make sure that we are getting this, that we're still getting feedback and bubbling it up. And we've got the surveys that go out. But I love the idea of having a small group of, you know, elected officials that are elected by the peers, and on a quarterly basis, they present their findings and then to the senior leadership team. And then we get a chance to, to review them. And 2 weeks later, oh, man, thank you. I'm legit gonna steal that. I'm gonna go talk to my senior team about it on Wednesday.
I stole it from ZocDoc, and everything that I have ever done successfully, I've stolen shamelessly from someone else. So,
I think that's every piece of sales knowledge that I have in my in my brain is all stolen from other people. Nothing original came from here. I'm curious on the quarterly eMPS. So where do the MPSs come from? Are these from customers, from prospects?
Oh, sorry. No, eNPS is Employee Net Promoter Score. So we survey our employees and they turn around in the same way that we would survey our customers, by the way. So rather than do an NPS, we do an eNPS, and we just look for those trends, right? Who's happy, who's passive, who's detractor. And we calculate a score, and we just measure it from an org department, from like in a complete department, then we break it down to the individual teams, and then we break it down into individual themes. And so we can kind of see what's trending in what direction and know where we have to spend our time.
Gotcha. Okay. I was thinking that you were having customers do MPSs for the individual reps that they were selling to. I thought that's going to be a complicated one.
Not a bad idea, but no.
I think the trouble would be in, like, just like you said on Glassdoor, it's either going to be the people who are going to respond to those surveys are going to be either very, very happy because they just closed, right? And there's that sort of like reaffirming, I've already made a buying decision with this person, and so I'm bound to think they're awesome. Or I think they're terrible, and, you know, it's going to be 5-star, 1-star.
We used to do that on when a deal would close, the person that we sold it to, the decision maker, would get a quick survey that just said, like, rate your salesperson. And I mean, no surprise, the ones that closed were fives, right? That's why they, probably a big part of the reason they bought. But yeah, it kind of became meaningless data almost.
Crazy. So at this point, if I could just kind of summarize, you know, where we started. You got to get people coming in the door. And so it's all about hiring correctly, making sure their vision values are aligned, making sure they've got the right background in terms of the sales motion. And then making sure that as we're transitioning, we are covering their goals and expectations in the hiring process, that during onboarding, those are getting signed off on, they're getting reviewed and signed off on as they graduate. Then after graduation, they're getting put into a learning program that's not just one and done onboarding. It's continuous. And they've got their onboarding buddies and their coaches. And you've got different coaches at different stages and for different skill sets. And then from there, you're managing the career path, which is, you know, how do I make sure that each individual has something that's short term that they can focus on driving towards, that isn't just quota, that makes it, that just adds that much, a lot more context to the role, and it pulls it out of the monotony of, I hit, like you said, I hit my quota 18 months in a row. I'm kind of bored. What do I do next? Which also builds on, you know, getting compensation right. And I haven't done it myself, but I think it's a really interesting model, the Jason Lemkin, no commission until you pay yourself back plus 20%. And then you get massive commissions. Point of clarity, just, is that on a monthly basis or is it on an annualized basis?
For us, it was on a monthly basis because we're on a, you know, 9-day, 10-day sales cycle. So people got paid every month. And so they could pay off their seat costs pretty easily every month.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Yep. And then you're coming back to outside of the commission plan, we are recognizing often. So you're doing little spiffs of, you know, if we close, if we go, you know, 20 days consecutively booking 48 demos, we've got, you know, $50 in the, an extra $50 or an extra $1,000 that you could win. You've got your sales, your quarterly sales awards for, mm-hmm. and again, it's not inputs, it's outputs driven. So the person that drove the most SMB business, most enterprise business, which I love, you're focusing on surprising and delighting people. And so we're focusing on personal gifts, not necessarily monetary cash. And in order to do this, you need to pay attention to their hobbies, to the things that they love, and then find something when they're kicking ass, find something that's really, truly meaningful. And they will hang on to that mattress forever. And then finally, we are getting a strong, we're creating a strong feedback loop. So they've got the anonymous solution focused suggestion box. You're doing a quarterly NPS from the team to find out, hey, are we as a company doing a great job? And then you save the best for last year, man. The Senate team of having those ambassadors that are there to collect and solicit feedback from the sales team and bring them to the senior leadership team. And that is the icing on the cake. I want to lead with, talk to me about the impact that you've seen getting this right have on an organization.
Yeah, for us, it was fast scale, right? Scaled from 0 to 50 million in 4 years, right? Which is pretty incredible. And for us, it was high employee net promoter score. So when I left Patient Pop, the employee net promoter score on the sales side was around 54, which would make that world class. And what does that mean? It means you retain top performers. So, you know, I only lost three top performers in my tenure, and one of them came back. And to me, I think that's pretty darn good over the course of 4 years. So it means stability. It means good revenue, and it means happy salespeople. And to me, those are three things that make my life easier.
Beautiful. I couldn't have said it better myself, Justin. I want to give you a chance to promote yourself. This is my favorite part of the podcast. So we're going to do a quick cold call role play. Understand that as somebody who's been building revenue teams for quite a while, that this is probably not a part of your day job. So I'll take it easy.
It's not. That's cool, man.
So set the context. What's your persona? What's your ICP? What role am I playing? And what type of company?
Cool. You're founder of a company that recently closed a Series A, because I call on founders. And perfect. I actually don't make cold calls. They come inbound, but I haven't made a cold call in a really long time. So this should be probably an atrocious disaster, but we'll give it our best shot. So I'll call you. You can be a founder, and you know, we'll go from there.
Sounds great. All right, ready? Ring, ring. Hey, this is Colin.
Colin, it's Justin Welsh. We recently connected on LinkedIn. How are you?
Hey, Justin. Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Hey, congratulations on the recent Series A from Insight Ventures. It's a great firm. You must be really pumped.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah, we're super excited.
Cool. Where are you planning on investing the capital? I'm always interested in learning what companies are doing with their Series A.
Yeah, it's. I mean, we really just worked out the mechanics. The sort of unit economics here. And so it's all going into sales and marketing.
That's great. Congratulations. I work with early stage companies, typically post Series A, kind of like you all, who are really growth focused. My clients are typically looking at the capital that they've raised, and they're investing it in sales and marketing engine to grow revenue. It sounds kind of like what you guys are planning on. Is that right?
That's right.
Cool. Could you tell me a little bit more about your plans? I'd love to hear what specifically is the biggest focus. Is it marketing? Is it sales? How are you thinking about going to market?
Well, we've got a couple different avenues. I mean, I think first is we want to, and here's where we're maybe a little bit unsure, is we know we need to hit our goals. We need to double or even triple the size of our sales team, but we're in this chicken or the egg scenario, which is, do we grow marketing and the number of leads and the number of top of funnel first, or do we grow the number of salespeople first?
That's a very common occurrence. I'm hearing what I hear from about 90% of the founders that I talk to right after their Series A. Is it marketing first? Is it sales first? Is it leads? When do the leads plateau? How do I start thinking about going outbound? I also heard a word in there that I hear often, which is unsure. Could I make a recommendation, if you don't mind?
Sure.
Cool. Why don't we set up 30 minutes, you and me, and I'll review the first pass that you put together for your go-to-market. And if you think my feedback is valuable, then we can talk about what it might look like for me to help support your go-to-market efforts with my firm. I support pre or post Series A, early stage founders who are looking to do exactly what you're doing. And I thought my analysis may save you some of the trouble that I had earlier in my career when I made some big mistakes. And if I can save you some expensive mistakes, it might be worthwhile. What do you think?
Sounds great. Also, for somebody who doesn't cold call, one of the best we've had on in a while. Justin, thank you so much for coming on, man.
Cool. Glad you liked it, Colin. Thanks for having me. And I made it through the toughest part.
Oh, dude, you crushed it. If people are in love with the cold call and they're thinking, hey, I'm in that sweet spot, post Series A, looking for a little advice, what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Yep. They can go to my website at theofficialjustin.com. That's theofficialjustin.com. They can email me at hello@theofficialjustin.com, or they can connect with me on LinkedIn, where I post usually every morning, or they can follow me on Twitter at Justin Sass, Justin S-A-A-S.
Right on. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Justin.
Colin, thanks for having me, man.
Right on. See everybody else next week.
Bye. All right. Shout out to Predictable Revenues, Service LinkedIn Outbound, Service for sponsoring this video. As a founder and sales leader myself, I know most of the best practices in terms of like what I need to be doing on LinkedIn. But sometimes I just don't have the time. You know what the right things to do are, but it just it comes down to a trade-off of where's my time better spent? And can I find somebody to click around on LinkedIn for me and book meetings, you know, and then I can focus on higher level activities. And so think about it. What's the best use of your time? If you're a founder, sales leader, and you have a team, you need some meetings, I'd encourage you to check it out. I'm using it myself. I'm obviously the founder, so I'm eating our own dog food. But if you're curious, click the link below to learn more.